Rachel Cochrane here with Wendy Robertson at her home in Bishop Auckland. We are sat in Wendy's study in front of a crackling fire, and Wendy is going to introduce her new novel, Writing at the Maison Bleu, and read extracts. The novel is available on Amazon.
My novel, Writing at the Maison Bleu, features seven very different writers who meet at the Maison Bleu at the Canal du Midi. Today, I'm going to read something about three of the writers, including Ruthie Danson, who comes from South Durham, incidentally, and she has found the Maison Bleu and has gone into partnership with a French woman, Aurélie Lebrun, and set up this retreat for writers. The first passage is about Joe, who is the youngest writer on the retreat, and he's won it as a prize in a competition. It was on Gyro Day when the award letter came through Joe's door. He celebrated his award with his girlfriend Lola at the Black Bull, their usual meeting place, on a corner at a decent distance from their respective hostels. £1,000, yum! Lola smacked her pouting lips. Not really a pretty sight. We can celebrate on that, Joe. For Lola, celebrating meant something serious up her nose or down her throat. At least, thought Joe, she did this in a quiet fashion. She'd told him more than once that she hated anything vulgar. There were people around them who were vulgar, and that, she said, was the worst thing in the world. Joe shook his head. No cash, lol, really like. Says here the award covers the plain and this place on the river. Sunshine and writing and talking. He frowned. Dunno whether I like that, talking. He grinned. Good job I got a passport, he said thoughtfully. His social worker had got him a passport when Johnny Green, a singer who had been in the same care home before his rise to fame, had treated the present generation of kids there to a beach holiday in Spain. In the end, Joe had not gone because he'd been in a fight and was seen to have blotted his copybook. Now Lola pouted, her eyes gleaming through the long blackened lashes that flapped against her fringe. Not fair that, Joey. You should see some cash, shouldn't you? Won the competition, didn't you? Until today, he hadn't talked very much about his writing with Lola. The writing was mostly his private thing. In his heart of hearts, Joe agreed with Lola. He wondered if all the winners of the Room to Write awards got their prize in vouchers and tickets, or was it just those who lived in hostels for outsiders? Maybe it was like clothes vouchers for the needy. He knew he was not as needy as some of his other acquaintances, because luckily, drugs had turned out to be not his bag. It was a fact that drugs had been pushed onto him in prison when things became hard. And it was true that when he got out he was still using. But he'd been rescued from sliding down that road by a guy called Cragen, who he met at the Black Bull. Cragen helped him to get off the gear for good. These days, even the thought of the gear made him gag. He stuck to bottled beer. Cragen, a strange and easy kind of man, turned out to be some kind of counsellor or psych. At first, Joe thought the older man was hitting on him. After 10 minutes in his company, it was clear to Joe that he was not. After several conversations at the bar of the Black Bull, Cragen finally convinced Joe that he really didn't have an addictive personality. He'd just been having a very bad time in his life and was self-medicating. After a while, this made sense to Joe, and he just stopped using drugs at all. It took 3 months, but at the end, it was like gradually switching on a bright, irritating light and seeing things as they really were. After that, Joe felt he could hear, smell and taste like a newborn, and life was better. And now we come to Francine, who is the oldest person at the retreat of seven writers. Francine is in her 80s. She's what they call a veteran writer, well-known, quite famous, something like Barbara Cartland or Catherine Cookson, and also like some of the RNA ladies I met, that is, the Romantic Novelists Association. These are really feisty ladies. Francine's husband has just died, and she decides to go to the Maison Bleu to work on her memoirs. Her memoirs are the spine of the book, that hers is the most important story. And here's Francine at the beginning of the story. The next day, after Francine had sent the cheque for the Maison Bleu retreat, she started to think about Ruthie Danson, odd name that. This was the writer who had written some half-decent detective novels set in Scarborough, Whitby and North Yorkshire. Although there were some upsetting scenes in the novels, Francine rather liked Daphne Breyers, Ruthie Dancing's detective, who was very wry and earthy. In fact, she was quite appealing. After all, a midwife would know many secrets of a community. Life and death were commonplace to midwives. Francine had observed that for herself when she was very young, far away in another country. As she gathered her clothes to pack, her thoughts went back to Robert, who had never liked the fact that Francine always insisted on travelling light. On their cruises, he was disappointed that she didn't pack a different new dress for dining every evening, like the wives of his friends. But now, with no Robert to worry about, she contemplated her list for her stay at the Maison Bleue. One pair of pink ventilator trainers, one pair of black ballet slippers, one pair of red ballet slippers, one pair espadrilles, two pairs of well-cut canvas trousers. One pair of these, bought in the Army and Navy stores in 1975, was very old. They washed very well. Robert had hated them, only fit for gardening. One pair very good linen trousers, one long linen skirt, two Max Mara linen jackets, one red, one blue. One bias-cut magenta silk dress from her mother's trunk, the only thing that remained with her of her mother's life. Hair ribbons and two sun hats, three silk shirt blouses, five silk scarves. The usual Marks and Spencer knicker stuff. She rolled up all these items except for the hats and fitted them into the bottom of her small carry-on case. On top of these, she put a fat notebook from Ryman's that would do duty for her as both notebook and diary. She added two copies of her most recent novels as lucky talisman. Into the side, she tucked a mint-condition plastic toilet bag that she bought in Harrods in 1960. On the very top of these, she arranged her folding straw hats, then the velvet plastic box of bobby pins, with which she pinned up her hair every night so that every day her thick, once red, now white hair could bounce into a cloud of curls. These same pins had curled her hair every single day of her life since Chuck, the American who had brought the drugs that mended her eye, also presented her with a box of pins. He had kissed her on the nose and said, "All the rage back home, honey, my mum and sister wouldn't be without him." The fact was that the bobby pins made her think of Chuck every night of her life as she sat before the mirror and pinned up her hair. Robert had disliked the pins and told her it was like going to bed with a hedgehog. "Why not," he said, "have her hair permed? All sensible women of her age did that, didn't they?" The very last thing she tucked into a case were Ruthie Dancing's letter and a folder containing the papers of Butcher's paper journal and the photograph of herself on the bicycle. Then she wrote to Ruthie Dancing, asking her to obtain for her a small Acer laptop, she included the serial number, and the smallest printer she could find. It was wonderful to be travelling light, Francine thought. Now she was ready. The last extract is the arrival of the celebrity writer, Kit Hallam, at the Maison Bleue. Many prominent retreats have celebrity writers. Some of them are wonderful, some of them are not wonderful. Anyway, Kit arrives by boat, tying up at the end of the garden of the Maison Bleue. Rachel thinks he's an intruder and shouts at him from an upper window at the house. This chapter is called Making an Entrance. Kit Hallam looked with characteristic resignation at the mad screaming woman in the upper window and continued to arrange the bottles in a 3x3 formation on the long table. Then he picked up his rucksack and case and made his way to the shallow steps that led up to the house from the courtyard. He tripped on the bottom step, shallower than the others, and his rucksack flew from his hand and crashed to the black stone pavement skirting the house. His brain registered the dull crack of his laptop as it took the hit. He lifted it up to peer inside to assess the damage, only to realise that until he opened it, he wouldn't know whether or not it was broken. Ahead of him, the madwoman, the screaming having subsided, was making her brisk way down another flight of shallow steps that led into the house. He slung the rucksack on his shoulder, took the blue silk handkerchief that dripped from his pocket and mopped his brow, contemplating the woman. Not enough meat on her for his taste, and her nose was slightly pink with sunburn. But she has something about her. Energy? A feline grace? He couldn't quite put his finger on it. Level with him now, her frown faded, and she smiled slightly as she recognised him. Now he had it. The woman had a look of Geraldine, his middle sister, who was not quite as mad as the others and was always his favourite. "You're early, Mr. Hallam," the woman said now, her laugh taking the edge off her accusation. "I thought you were an intruder." He could just make out a northern intonation, a distinct musicality in her voice. He smiled. "The name's really Kit, or Kitto, if you're under 16. Of course, Kit Hallam was a schoolmaster. He lifted his rucksack and held his case before him like a shield. "Defence," he thought, "is the best means of attack, unless you're Hitler or Napoleon. I think I did say the 14th. Is this the way?" "I have another suitcase in the boat," he said, making his way past her. Reduced to scurrying behind him, Ruthie said, "But it's only the 13th today, Mr. Hallam." "Whatever," he gasped, carefully putting down his bag in the kitchen doorway. "And as I said, it's Kit." "Yes, as you say, it hardly matters." She put away her anger and offered him her hand. "Kit, I'm Ruthie." His grip was surprisingly firm. "Thought you'd be older. A bit like that biddy of a midwife of yours, all upswept hair and rimless glasses." So he'd read at least one of her books. She laughed. "Do your readers expect you to be like the dashing Radnoy?" To her surprise, he blushed. "Well, they do, actually. Must be blind. Their faces fall when they see me at signings. Some of them look behind me for the real Christopher Hallam. I just tell them Radnoy's more like my brother than me." The blush had restored him to her favour. "Do you have a brother?" "No, actually, I just have sisters. More's the pity." She resisted the temptation to ask him about the sisters. "I see you have brought wine," she said. "Found this little vineyard 7 miles away," he said. "Thought it worth a try. A gift for the Maison Bleu." Kit Hallam went on to say the right words about his room. The size, the appointments, the view across the city, all seemed to please him. Ruthie did say that the rooms at the back looked down the garden across the canal. But he assured her he enjoyed the distant city view. "I've lived deep in the country for more years than I can remember. I like a city view. Makes me feel connected." He turned down her offer to make him dinner. "I'll walk down to the town and find something there." He also wanted to check out the possibility of hiring a scooter. For some reason, he didn't want to tell the woman of that idea. She might be embarrassed, think it juvenile. She might offer him her car or something. He hated favours. So those are four of the writers in Writing at the Maison Bleu. And the next chapter starts, So It Begins, and that's where the story begins.
Thank you, Wendy. That was Wendy Robertson reading from her novel Writing at the Maison Bleu, available from Amazon.